Good afternoon, everyone. Having achieved quorum, we'll convene. Welcome to special hearing of the Labor and Consumer Protection Division. Representative Ruth Avina. I trust you've been with me before.
Yes, I can.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're having a little trouble with the sound system due probably to my cell phone, but I'm going to ask all of you to turn off yours in the process, if you would, please.
Yeah, I don't know how to turn mine off.
Step on it.
You clearly know how to answer it, though.
I do know how to do it.
Representative Ruth Avina, your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah. Representative Mahoney. I always confuse you two. Representative Mahoney, would you like to move file 1169?
Yes, sir, I
will. All right. Representative Mahoney moves 1169 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and continuing on my theme of fine American, the bill that it does requires that any public employee that's required to have a uniform or safety apparel or whatever, that item be manufactured in the United States of America, and it goes on to say that preference should be given to manufacturers who pay wages and benefits equal to at least 100% of the federal poverty guidelines for a family of four, and that figure is approximately $1,590 per hour for a family of four. So, of course, that would go down proportionally as members, it's pretty straightforward bill. I feel, you know, one of the things that I think, and perhaps I'm not always right, but one of the sad things about this economic situation we're in, and I think one of the causes of it, is that we don't make a lot of things in this country anymore. We still make some pretty expensive items, whether it's Boeing planes or a lot of military equipment and that, but in other areas we're not making that much. So I've always, Mr. Chair and members, successful in finally getting a flag sold in the States that hasn't been required to be made in the United States of America. So I come forward with this bill, and I have with me a James Smith from the ACRE United States.
Very good. Ms. Krunick, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is J-A-Y-E, Rakunik, R-Y-K-U-N-Y-K. And I am here representing Workers United, which is Manufacturing, Clothing, and Textile Workers International Union, which will be, we have literally thousands of textile workers left in the United States. Many of those are unionized jobs. They provide good wages and they provide good benefits. Since the passage of NAFTA, we've lost more than 1.2 million manufacturing jobs, exclusively in the textile and the apparel industry. However, it is a requirement by the U.S. military that all military uniforms are made in the United States. There are manufacturing plants scattered throughout the southern United States. Many of those are unionized plants which are producing uniforms. And those plants have the capacity to increase their production. By way of example, I want to talk about Chisholm, Minnesota. There is a plant in Chisholm, Minnesota, which is called Extreme Design. It wasn't too long ago that Extreme Design employed more than 60 people. They manufacture shirts, they manufacture safety vests, and they have the capacity to manufacture uniforms. We now have between 12 and 10 people employed there on a regular basis, still manufacturing safety vests, still have the full capacity in that factory, in that sewing factory, to manufacture the products that we need in our state. The global apparel industry is one of the world's largest manufacturing industry, and there are literally tens of millions of workers in the industry. Most of those workers are women, Many of them are young, and although I normally don't wear this kind of a shirt, I wore this specifically as an example. This is a shirt which is made in India. And all these little beads on this shirt are sewn on this shirt by young women. And when I say young women, I'm talking about women with small, nimble fingers who are 12 and 13 years old. The abuses in the apparel industry are well known. They've been documented. And as people who live and are concerned in our country about the economic condition in our country and the welfare of our citizens, taking a long view and looking at clothing and uniforms that are made in our country, I think that it is a patriotic thing to do. The sweat-free procurement strategies have been led by college students. McAllister College has a sweat-free procurement policy for all of the clothing that goes there. There has been sweat-free procurement for soccer balls. The University of Minnesota has a very strong group. University-licensed apparel, there are over 150 universities, are members of the Workers' Rights Consortium, which has a code of conduct which talks about the kinds of products that they are willing to sell at their universities as licensed apparel. Under public procurement, there are dozens of cities, counties, and states, and school boards have passed laws mandating a sweat-free code of conduct. States with sweat-free laws include Maine, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, California, Illinois, Ohio, and Vermont. Cities with sweat-free laws include Milwaukee, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon. Every public transit authority worker in Boston is required to wear American-made apparel as part of their policy. They have no difficulty in providing those uniforms and procuring them in the United States. Minnesota should be next. We should pass sweat-free procurement. We should support this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the author of the testifier on House File 1169? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 1169? We've got two.
Good afternoon. My name is Wayne Nguyen with the League of Minnesota Cities. At this point, we have more questions and concerns about the bill. Just looking through the bill, we have questions about how cities would comply with the provisions of the bill and concerns that it does create another mandate on local governments. Looking at the bill, it's not clear how cities are supposed to identify the manufacturer and if they comply with living wage preferences in the bill. Our question is, would all 855 cities in Minnesota have to individually research and contact the companies to make sure that the products manufactured comply with the bill, and if they comply with prevailing wage? Currently, there is no easy way for cities to do this. Another question we have is, what if a city cannot identify an American company that manufactures the apparel equipment needed? Could there be some type of waiver for public employers who tried but could not find the company? And finally, could there be or would there be some state agency responsible for perhaps identifying the companies beforehand for the local government so that we don't individually have to identify the companies? And if there would be a state agency responsible for overseeing the compliance if this bill were to pass. Also, it would be difficult for us to really quantify the cost that this bill would have on local governments right now because currently we don't have to undertake these things. So, with that, those are just some of the concerns that we have.
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. Mr. Chairman, I believe these provisions apply especially to our citizens. So the personnel who work with school districts, we hear some of the city's same concerns and feel a little bit of kicking cold here at this point. We're asked to reduce mandates and yet this is sort of mean. We're asked to share services because local boards don't seem qualified to make purchasing decisions on their own. And yet for these items, we're to look for American made and not necessarily advice. So we really would like you to sort of establish our parameters and then support local governments as we go forward and not sort of
bounces around.
All right. What would we do if we weren't bouncing you around? questions for either of the testifiers. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against House File 1169? Representative Rukavina, you get the last word, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and I think that there's evidence that in other cities than that, and especially the federal government, that require Made in USA uniforms, that it's not that hard to find them. Number one, but I think it's sad that the League and School Board Association are concerned about the bill. If anybody should be supporting Made in USA, I would think it would be them down to the local unit of government. I can't see any problem with actually adhering to the letter of the law. And in fact, Mr. Chair, members, I've gotten calls from all over the country regarding that flag bill. I just got a call 2 days ago from a state representative in Wisconsin. I've gotten from Louisiana and Alaska and everywhere else. So, I think a lot of people around the country are thinking that we should get back into the strong manufacturing base we used to have in the country. So I'd appreciate your support, Mr. Chair, that thank you for moving the bill, and I hope you can move it on to the next meeting.
We'll see what we can do here. We'll get back to you on that real briefly here, Representative Mahoney. All right. With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 1169 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in support indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Rukavina. Representative Clark. There she is. Very good. Representative Clark, welcome to the committee. Representative Fritz, would you like to move House File 326?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 326 to recommend that she pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Very good. I understand Representative Clark shares an author's amendment. Let me first check whether members have that in their possession. Coming around? Okay. Very good. Representative Fritz, would you like to move the 325A1 amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fritz.
326A1. Yeah.
My apologies. Thanks for the catch. No, that was good. Is this, Representative Clark, is this to get the bill in the form that you prefer?
Okay.
Thank you. With that, all in favor of the Fritz motion on the A1 amendment, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark, to your bill is amended.
House File 326 is a bill that would prohibit bisphenol A in the products of children. And the bill is maybe looks familiar to some of you. We passed it last year. It's on the floor of the House, and with some advice from the governor's office, took it out. But it passed both the floor of the House and the Senate. So I'm bringing it back. And what we'd like to do, again, is bring the bill back with some changes. We've been working on this for the last year. And we have put some exemptions in that I'll just call your attention. But basically, the bill would say that bisphenol A in a number of children's products, children 3 and under, we're going to have it phase out in Minnesota beginning January of 2010 for most products and January 2013 for infant formula containers. And that's one of the changes that we negotiated with the industry. And the bill also talks about the kinds of replacement chemicals that can take its place. We know there are alternatives. It's one of the important things for the committee to know, be reminded of. There are alternatives to this. We do not need to put a known endocrine disruptor, known carcinogen problem product in our products that affect our small children. We also, in this amendment today, made another effort to work with the industry so that retailers, if they have these products on their shelves, they can use them up until they're, in terms of infant formulas, until they're gone by October 12th. So we give some time for them to exhaust those stocks. The bill also allows the Pollution Control Agency to participate in a multi-state clearinghouse. Might indicate that this product is already banned in Canada as of October, and there are 14 other states that are looking at it right now. Again, just to remind folks, some of the studies that are in the handout that you have goes through the problems that we know are linked to bisphenol A in products, and everything from, because it mimics estrogen, everything from abnormalities in the male reproductive tract, onset of uber early puberty in girls, low sperm counts, prostate and breast cancer, miscarriage, obesity, diabetes, and insulin resistance, as well as behavioral disorders and learning disabilities like ADD and ADHD, and then problems with the immune system in general. Also, cardiovascular disease and liver disruption. And those studies are all peer-reviewed, and they're listed here for you to look at if you get into that. There's also some breaking news that's pretty exciting. You know, when you bring a bill forward like this, especially since we've had a year to look at it, there's a response from industry. They know that there are alternatives. And so I'd like to actually turn the next part of the session over to Michelle, because we are hearing from more and more parts of the industry that are willing to respond to the consumer's demand and request that parents, for example, know that when they're buying baby bottles, they're free of bisphenol A, or when they're dealing with infant formulas. So I would like to ask Michelle to share with you some of the news that we just...
Michelle, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lindsay Dahl, and I work for Healthy Legacy. We are a Minnesota-based public health coalition that has 31 different member organizations that really span across different disciplines. So we have health-affected groups like ARC and the Learning Disabilities Association. We also have groups like the Minnesota Council of Churches and the Minnesota Parent Teacher Association. So we're a really diverse coalition that's working to support this bill, House File 326. I'm just going to talk kind of about the things that relate to this committee as far as this bill goes. Like Representative Clark mentioned, major companies and retailers are moving to phase this chemical out. So there's a list that you guys have received of major retailers that are saying, you know, we're not going to carry bisphenol A-laden baby bottles on our shelves in response to consumers. Now, the kind of important thing is that some retailers are moving and some companies are really moving, but at the end of the day, the parents we work with want to be able to go into any store, no matter what the retailer is, and know that all the baby bottles and baby products are BPA-free. So that's really the importance of this legislation. I do have some products that, just to show you, there are safer alternatives, as Representative Clark mentioned, that are already on the market. So, for example, this three-pack is $2.99 that you can go to local retailers and buy. Also, there was a question about this from the last committee, but we contacted Similac again and again and again, and they continue to say that these infant formula, both their powdered packets and their liquid infant formula, these products are BPA-free. So if you call the company and you ask them, these products are BPA-free. So it just goes to show that this legislation, since it is narrowly crafted, wouldn't be extremely burdensome. And I know that both Senator Rummel and Representative Clark are working with the Toy Industry Association to potentially narrow the focus of the toy language. So that's also an important thing. I'd also just like to mention that both Nestle Nutrition, they have sent a letter to Congress noting that they already have BPA-free infant formula products that they are selling. So I have a copy of this if anyone wants to see this. And then also, probably the biggest news is that last week, Sunoco, which is a chemical company that makes bisphenol A, it was the first chemical company to raise concerns about the safety about the chemical. So this is kind of groundbreaking. And they're saying, you know, this, the chemical that we make, we're not going to sell it to people that will use it in products for children ages 3 and under, so food and beverage packaging. So basically, as Healthy Legacy, like I said, I'm representing a really diverse coalition. At the end of the day, parents just really want to know that the products are free of BPA before they go into the store. And this legislation would let a lot of parents rest a little bit easier. And I'll stand for questions.
Any questions to the author or her testifier?
Can we go through questions first, or is there something you want to testify again?
We can do that. I just thought we'd take you folks first. And seeing none,
The question we had before, and this is, I trust that it's supposed to be just for the feeding part of this, and that's what product you have up there. On line 1.15 of the bill, I'm not sure that that takes care of feeding tubes, IV tubes, that kind of thing. That language still looks again, to me, I have not had a chance to talk to children's NICU, any place like that, but to be particular, it's a very, very important issue. I'm just curious if this is language being left wide open for that purposes, or I really don't understand it. So I'm sure the author of the bill would help me.
But to the author. Representative Clark.
The area, and I forgot to mention it when I was introducing the bill, that we are working with the medical industry on the issue of tubing to make sure that we're not jeopardizing tubing that needs to be used, for example, like the dear little brand new babies when they were very, very small in the intensive care unit. So it hadn't really come to our attention that this was in that tubing until very recently, but we are talking with them, and actually, maybe Ms. Dahl, I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Ms. Dahl?
Mr. Chair, members, thanks. I just want to note that it's definitely something we're working on. It was raised in the Health Committee, and it's a valid concern. And so we've met with the pediatric group. And so we're kind of delving into what medical products would be included and if it's appropriate addressing those concerns. So it's something we're working towards, but we don't have language for today.
We have at least some of the
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 326? Sir, please come to the table. Am I right that it's welcome back? Welcome back to the committee?
I think so.
Reintroduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Steve Henches, and I'm with the American Chemistry Council, and I came here today to talk with you about bisphenol A, which is a subject that is of more than just passing interest to me since I've been intimately involved in the science on bisphenol A for about the last 9 years. And as you've heard or you otherwise know by now, bisphenol A is used primarily to make two things, polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. These are not new materials. They've all been around and safely used for about 50 years, actually more than 50 years now. And they are very widely used today in an array of consumer products ranging from things like eyeglass lenses, shatterproof eyeglass lenses, to sports safety equipment such as hockey helmets or bicycle helmets, CDs and DVDs, most any piece of electronic equipment you can think of, including electronic toys. And, of course, they're also used in polycarbonate is also used to make baby bottles and other food storage containers. Epoxy resins are very durable, chemically resistant materials. They are quite suitable for use as coatings, and they are almost universally used as the protective coating in most food and beverage cans, including canned liquid infant formula. And the purpose of that coating, the purpose of the epoxy resin coating, is to protect the safety and integrity of the contents of the can. Bisphenol A, over its long history of safe use, is now one of the best tested of all substances in commerce. And what that means is that we have an extraordinarily rich scientific database to assess the safety of bisphenol A. I'm not going to try to go through that science. There's way too much, and yes, you would appreciate that you don't want to go through it. But what I want to do is jump to the bottom line, because the science has been comprehensively reviewed by many government bodies, regulatory agencies around the world, in particular in the last couple of years. And there is now a consensus amongst these regulatory bodies around the world that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health, including the health of infants and children. And that's particularly true at the very low levels of bisphenol A that people, including infants, could be exposed to. I think that was me. Could be exposed to.
It might have been the cookie I just had.
So that's particularly true that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health at the very low levels that people, including infants, could be exposed to from the use of consumer products. Perhaps most notable are the views of the government agencies in Europe, and the reason I think that is particularly notable is that in Europe, the so-called precautionary principle has been adopted. And if you don't know the precautionary principle by that name, it very, very frequently is described as being better safe than sorry. That's a simple way of thinking about it. Well, that precautionary principle has been adopted in Europe. Nevertheless, after reviewing the science in Europe and applying the precautionary principle, the European Union, the European governments have found no reason to take any action on bisphenol A, and indeed products made from bisphenol A are accepted as safe for use, and they are very widely used in Europe. More recently, we've heard from, just in the last half year or so, we've heard from individual European countries who have also taken a look at the scientific record and have indicated their concurrence that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health. For example, just in the last half year, we've heard from the French Food Safety Authority, the German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment, and the Danish Environmental Protection Agency, all concurring with the views of the European Union about bisphenol A not being a risk to human health. Just in February of this year, the Swiss health authorities, it's the Gesundheit für It's the Swiss. I've lost my German language skills, so it's the Swiss health authority. Just in February of this year, they issued a statement after they reviewed the science, and they concur with the views of the European Union. That's significant because Switzerland is not part of the European Union, so that's an independent view. And then just in March of this year, Australia and New Zealand issued a statement in which they also indicated that after reviewing the science, they find no risk to human health. So there are others. FDA, you may have heard elsewhere, FDA has a safety assessment that is in progress right now. They've issued a draft report back in August, which was consistent with others worldwide. But FDA is not complete yet, so we can't really say that we know what their final conclusion will be. They have an assessment that's under progress right now. Up in Canada, the Canadian government has also completed an assessment of bisphenol A, and their safety assessment concluded it was very consistent with everyone else around the world. And I'll quote from what they said. What they said is, the current research tells us the general public need not be concerned. In general, most Canadians are exposed to very low levels of bisphenol A, therefore it does not pose a health risk. Now, you heard earlier that Canada has gone ahead and proposed to ban polycarbonate baby bottles on a precautionary basis. They've not actually done that yet, but they have proposed it, similar to what you are proposing here, or what you are reviewing here. But there is a consensus worldwide among government bodies who have reviewed the science. All have found that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health. I also want to touch on the subject of safer alternatives. You heard that mentioned a little bit earlier. Considering the very rich scientific database available for bisphenol A, there are no alternatives that have been tested anywhere near as well as bisphenol A. None. And so when you hear talk about safer alternatives, there is no data to actually back that up. And that was the Swiss government, in the statement they put out in February, actually commented on that if you were to replace bisphenol A, or really polycarbonate plastic, with an alternative, you would be moving to something that is less well-tested, less well-characterized. And in that regard, I thought I would mention that one of the alternatives is this very common plastic that I'm drinking out of right now, and so are you.
I bet you loved it when you walked in and saw me with this.
I certainly did, and I saw at least one other Bozzy drinking out of it now. And enjoying it. And what I wanted to mention is that PET is one of the alternatives that can be used to replace polycarbonate plastic in some applications, not all, but in some. So I found it very interesting, this paper that this was published in the scientific literature last week, raising questions about the safety of PET, and specifically reporting that bottled mineral water of the type that we're drinking may be estrogenic. And for those of you who have looked at the science on bisphenol A, the claim about bisphenol A is that it is weakly estrogenic. Now, I mention this not to suggest that PET is safe. I really don't know based on that paper, and as you can see, that paper hasn't deterred me from using the product at all. But the reason I mention it is that it highlights the point that I just made. There are no alternatives that have been tested even remotely as well as bisphenol A. This paper about 10 years ago might have been interesting if it were bisphenol A, but we're way beyond that with bisphenol A. We've done far more research on bisphenol A than any of the alternatives. That's exactly where I am. So in conclusion, what I would encourage you to do is to consider the views of the government bodies worldwide who have reviewed the science and have all concluded that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health. I'd also encourage you to give FDA the time to complete their assessment, the one that they have in progress right now, and to take appropriate action based on their findings. They are our federal regulator. To the extent that this is an issue or a concern, it is a national concern. So I'd encourage you to let FDA finish their assessment, take appropriate action based on their findings. And you might be aware that President Obama just nominated a new FDA commissioner just a few days ago. So please let FDA finish their work, take actions based on their findings. I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Pritt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Hentges, is it?
Yes.
Yes, and Dr. Hentges. Are you a medical doctor?
PhD.
Okay, but you are not a medical doctor.
PhD, and I spent most of my career in health and environmental matters.
And I have spent 45 years of my life as a nurse and a grandmother, and I'm very concerned about the product.
as a grandmother at this stage of my life especially. And, you know, I'm also as a Minnesotan and in the United States, and you've talked about the global, the worldwide folks who are saying that this is a safe product. However, I don't feel safe. I feel very unsafe buying products with that in it, and I think that's the culture. And that is not the science yet, but I'm getting it. And again, as a nurse, when I think about the catheters and the feeding tubes and things like that that I insert for length periods of time, I'm concerned about those folks as well. So although you've had quite a bit of information here that you shared with us about the world, I'm not thinking that this is harmful. I do think that the United States, the FDA, and I do keep my ear to that study. But I also here in Minnesota with my own grandchildren feel as though I could not purchase something with that in it today. So, but thank you for your testimony. Just wanted to see what your comments were about that.
Go ahead. Sure. We recognize that many people like you are concerned about the safety of this. What we always try to do is bring it back to the science, partly because there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of myths about this. It's very difficult for consumers, even people who are like you, who are in the health business, to really figure out what's going on. So we always try to drive it back to the science and drive it back to the experts who can evaluate it. And that's why we always go back. We rely quite heavily on the views of government bodies worldwide. We have to. They've got the expertise to review the science, and they do. They look at it. They look at all of it. They have looked at all of it. So, again, FDA is in the middle of their process, and we also understand, we recognize that a lot of people have had concerns about the integrity of our federal agencies. There have been concerns there, but that's why I say give FDA the chance. With President Obama, he's got his new commissioner coming in. Give them the chance. I think what he has said recently is wanting to bring science back to scientific matters or something like that. Give them the chance to do that. Let FDA finish their job, see what they have to say about the science, and then come back to it. One very quick comment on alternatives. There always actually have been alternatives for products such as baby bottles. There always have been. They're out there. They're even more out there now than they ever have been before, and there's even a lot of transparency. I don't know if you've gone down the store aisle looking at baby bottles, but you don't have any trouble finding ones that are loudly labeled as being BPA-free. So they're there for anyone who does have concerns. Representative Fritz?
Yeah, and my follow-up would be the better safe than sorry, area, that for my, at the stage and age that I'm in, and looking at the change in people's behaviors in buying products like this, I think that in Minnesota, and for myself on this committee in the last year or two that Representative Clark has worked on this and educated us on it, I feel very much a part of that movement here in Minnesota. So I do think that we're leading the way in that area. The FDA, I think, will come with their conclusions, but in the meantime, I commend Representative Clark for continuing this and for the help that she's given myself and other parents and grandparents in Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
Actually, I wanted to have the witness on the other side and the chemical PhD.
From Ms. Dahl?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's all right. Apparently there is. Representative Mahoney has a question for Dr. Andrews and yourself.
Sure.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I've got a couple of questions, but, you know, I've got one witness telling me there are alternatives and another one telling me there is not. What's the story I need to listen to here? Because I got honorable truth-telling people telling me that there is and there isn't.
Well, Representative Mahoney, I can share that I had the pleasure Monday night about midnight to be in a drugstore getting a prescription filled for my six-year-old. And as I was killing time waiting for them to fill the prescription, I found some sippy cups, plastic sippy cups, that were advertised as BPA-free, phthalate-free, and they weren't free, they were $2.99, but,
horrible on legislative salary?
Yeah, exactly. But you get the drift. That clearly the manufacturer in this case had moved beyond current state and federal law to provide, to find alternatives and then advertise it, I assume, as a opportunity to drive some more sales their direction from concerned parents.
Dr. Andrew?
Yeah, again, to go back to BPA, there are two main uses, polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resin, for things like sippy cups and baby bottles made out of polycarbonate. There always have been alternatives. They've always been out there. They may not have been labeled as such, but they've always been there, and now they're probably most of the market. So they're out there right now. But what you mentioned is something very interesting about BPA-free, phthalate-free, and free of everything else. What that tells you is what they are not. It doesn't tell you what they are. And that's very important if you want to find out whether they're safer or safe. You got to know what they are. And my point before is that none of those alternatives have been tested anywhere nearly as well as bisphenol A. None. And what they don't tell you on the label is what they are and how safe is that. Now, the other product is epoxy resins used as the protective coatings in cans. And there are no good alternatives. There are... Epoxy resins are the preferred material for hand coatings, have been used for 50 years, widely used now. There are no good alternatives to replace epoxy resin.
Representative Mahoney.
And if Ms. Dahl can speak to the containers, because it seems like you just got an affirmative answer from the chemical, the other witness. So what about the baby food or the canned containers?
Ms. Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. This is something that actually we've got, I can send you a letter that was directly from Nestle Nutrition, who makes infant formula, to Congress, stating that they have products like the bisphenol A powder packets that I was saying, that are BPA-free. So it's straight from the company that makes infant formula.
Are they the only ones who make infant formula?
No, there's other companies that do. And so that's part of the reason for the need for this legislation. The second thing is that there's also other companies, like I think it's PBM, I have another letter, again, to Congress that I can send over to you, that they're the ones that make generic infant formula, and they're committed to making their entire line, not even just some products, but their entire line BPA-free in response to both the science and to consumer concerns. So... I just also want to touch on the issue of sippy cups and infant, or baby bottles, excuse me. Whether you're looking at plastics like polyethylene or PET, what have you, there's glass, there's old-fashioned glass, which doesn't leak anything. And then simultaneously, there's also a new biomaterials, which are really new, and Minnesota is a leader in those from NatureWorks, where they make plastic from biomass-based materials. So we know they don't leak synthetic estrogens that are derived from crude oil. So those baby bottles are more expensive, full disclosure. But there's alternatives that even extend beyond the universe of just petroleum-based plastics that are readily available.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Can I get a response to that from the chemical?
Briefly, please. This will be brief.
I'll just touch on that last comment. I think you heard it right there. One of the alternatives is really new, and that's true for a couple of them. So it has not been tested very thoroughly. It could not have been. Nothing close to BPA.
My question, I'll be more specific. If two baby formulas can be packaged without whatever this chemical is, what's the problem?
Not familiar with the specific products, but I think if you're talking about canned liquid infant formula, not powder, but canned liquid infant formula, my understanding is that most, if not all, of those are have an epoxy resin coating. Might have to get someone from those companies to be specific, but my understanding is for canned liquid infant formula, epoxy resin coatings are used.
I'm going to get around and around.
Representative Sellers, we'd like to move to a vote pretty quickly.
Sure. Well, Chairman, has a question, so that because based on the answer to the question, I may have an amendment, just an oral amendment to the bill, Mr. Chairman. And
all right.
Dr. Hinch, maybe this will help you, Representative Mahoney. When we're talking about peer review, and this is a subject that we got deep in the weeds, I was told there'd be no math, and this is way over my head with the math. Peer review is usually a time and tested, but it's not just a once or twice. It is a numeric, or we've peer reviewed this 15 times or 16. That's maybe the question, Representative Mahoney, in a roundabout way. What is the comparison to BPA to some of the new products that are the declared as alternative products?
So I'm not sure if you got the number off the top of your head. BPA has been tested 1,000 times, and the alternatives have been tested 10 or 15.
Dr. Hentges, well, you will find hundreds, perhaps thousands of studies published in the scientific literature on bisphenol A. For any alternative, you're going to you have trouble finding any. It's not to say there aren't any, but you will find a few.
Mr. Chair, following Representative Mahoney's line, Ms. Apologize.
Dahl.
If you'd, again, to the peer review, a number, I mean, because your comment was, and that was a big part of the discussion last year, is peer review for alternative products. Because, like Representative Clark, I don't want something else there that we find 5 years down the road hasn't had, what, 2 peer reviews, and we find out after 50 peer reviews that it was actually worse than BPA. So is there a number that we can say for specific products that will, it's close to the BPA studies or peer reviews?
Ms. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Rip Sons always. That's kind of a tricky question because BPA is a chemical that's used to make polycarbonate plastic, and a lot of the alternatives we talk about are different plastics in general. So BPA is a specific chemical, whereas other plastics can be made from different blends of chemicals, if that makes sense. So you can't, it's not an A versus B, it's kind of apples and oranges. And I don't have a number of, you know, how many times BPA has been tested and how many times the alternatives. I don't have a number for that. But I do know that's why Representative Clark included in her bill the language section 3 to make sure that replacement chemicals aren't known human carcinogens or reasonable anticipated human carcinogens. And I guess the kind of conclusion of what I'm saying is that I don't have hard numbers off the top of my head, but we know that there's products, even like glass, that don't leak anything. And, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Representative Clark wanted to...
Well, Representative Clark, extremely briefly.
I think Representative Mahoney, to respond to this question, if you look at Section 2, one of the things we did is we extended the date for bisphenol A in infant formula until 2013, so we can be really sure that there are even more products available from more companies. So I thought maybe if you hadn't seen that, it would come back.
Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the fact that we've got Representative Keats's bill coming up, which actually I had talked to him about last year after we'd gone through the BPA, the DECA, the phthalates debate, I think begs the question that I don't know that, I know Representative Clark has done a lot of work on it, so I don't know if we're going to get to Representative Keeson's bill, which is going to ban all these chemicals that we don't like or don't want, but that would be included in there. And again, the federal legislation's been talked about. But Mr. Chairman, may I make an oral amendment to the bill?
Representative Zellers, I wish you could. I wish you could. There is some confusion at the desk. You may have noticed a lot of conversations as to whether we have the proper engrossment and whether we added the proper amendment at the beginning of the hearing on this bill. So rather than make things more difficult, this isn't to the content of your amendment, I think what we will do at this time is lay the bill over, unpack the problems, make sure we've got things right, and then you're welcome to offer your amendment at that time, Representative Ellis. I think in terms of following proper procedure for the public's the public's ability to know what it is we're doing and why we're doing it, that's the proper course of events.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'll see and raise you. I'd like to move to table the bill.
Well, I've already tabled the amendment. I've already tabled it.
You laid it over.
Possible
inclusion. I would like to table the bill.
Representative Silver?
I think once it's laid over, so long as it's before.
Timing is everything.
Story of my life, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Yours too, huh? With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll take some time to unpack this and figure out the confusion we've had, and I apologize to the author and the public on that confusion. With that, Representative Thiessen, something short, simple, and straightforward for us? All right, thank you. Let's see here. Moving with the script. A double amendment. Woohoo! All right. The chair moves that House File 458 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. There's a chair's amendment. There's an author's amendment. The chair will move that amendment. Can you identify it for us, please?
146.
Okay. I've got a DE1.
It may be the same thing. Let me go.
You'd think it was February 2nd in here.
Or the
13th.
Yeah, this is it.
Okay. The chair will then move the 458 DE1 amendment to be before the committee. This is Representative Thiessen.
There's an amendment to this amendment then that makes a technical change.
All right. Let's move the let's accept the DE1 amendment first, and then we'll deal. No.
Sorry.
Chair, I was told there'd be no math.
Okay, the 458. Do you have a copy of the amendment, Representative Thiessen?
Oh, incorporated all that. Oh, we're all set. Sorry.
It's an oral amendment.
She actually did all the work for us already.
It's already been done. That's why we can stop looking for a second amendment. All right. Thank you, Ms. Newman. Ladies and gentlemen, the chair moves the DE1 amendment to be before the committee. This
can
is
I
to
make
get
one oral amendment.
Certainly.
Wait. Is the strike.
Are we on TV today?
Line 1.19.
Strike line 1.19. So that section 1 would read.
Just removing the Commissioner of Commerce from this panel.
1.19, excuse me. And then renumbering accordingly.
Yes.
Ms. Newman, are we okay?
Yes, Ms. Chair. Question for Representative Thiessen, you're on line 6, you've got a 15 voting member.
Yeah, this is
a non-voting member, so there's no effect there.
Right.
All right. Representative Mahoney.
Just for grammar, did you delete on page 1.19, did you delete the word and?
Yes, we need an and.
I haven't done anything yet.
Can I make a new amendment here?
Please.
Restate it.
Please.
Add an and on 1.18 at the end of the line. Delete 1.19 and change the 7 to a 6 and 1.20.
Okay. Ms. Newman, how are we doing?
That's perfect.
All right. The chair will incorporate that into that oral amendment into the DE1 amendment. With that, perfection is a rare quality around here. The chair moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Thiessen, do your bill as amended?
I hope my explanation bill takes as long as that just did.
Or less time.
So this is similar to it's kind of related to a bill that Representative Canute had before the committee, I think last week, related to, and a little bit related to the bill that you just passed, but it's to set up a process. It's to do two things. It's to set up a process to analyze these toxic chemicals as they come through. One of the challenges, you know, we hear all these in the Health Committee as well. One of the challenges I've seen is that we're not very good in the legislature at dealing with science and figuring out between two competing, you know, we have a bunch of studies on both sides sorting that out. And so this, as Representative Knuth's bill does, this tries to set up a process to deal with some of those issues outside the legislature so it can come with kind of scientific recommendations to the legislature. So what the bill does is it sets up an advisory council, and the makeup is essentially of scientists, of businesses, and of environmental health organizations, equally divided. And that group is tasked with really two things. One is to look, in comparison with Representative Canute's bill, which sets up a process within the state government to kind of analyze, develop a list of chemicals, et cetera, and kind of come up with identify the products that those chemicals are in. What this would do is just say this advisory committee, the department will just identify in the other states that are already doing this work, recommendations that they've made about how to regulate toxic chemicals in kids' products. And they'll present all those proposals with the backup to this advisory committee, and the advisory committee will say this one makes sense for Minnesota and this one doesn't. So the idea here is not to duplicate the work that other states like Washington, California, which has dozens of employees tasked with this job right now, what they're doing, rely on their work, but also retain the jurisdiction of Minnesota essentially to kind of make our own decision as to that. So this advisory council would take those recommendations and then recommend to us whether they make sense or not. And then we would act on those things. But at least at that point, we would have hopefully the science of it sorted out a little bit better in kind of from an objective point of view. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it also, looks at this issue of toxic chemicals and green chemistry, replacing toxic chemicals with green chemistry as an economic development potential for Minnesota. And so Section 4 really also tasks this advisory council with developing a framework of how Minnesota can take its current economic advantages in, having companies like Cargill, for instance, which does a lot with agricultural products, and also the fact that we have a lot of agriculture in this state, and our university, which has a focus on biology and biosciences, and see what can we do as a state to actually take the lead and develop industries that will develop these green chemistries and develop businesses that arise out of green chemistry, so that we're the folks that are making these products that don't include toxic chemicals here in Minnesota. So it's kind of a two-pronged bill. That's it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Questions for the author? Representative Nelson.
I'm hoping not a can of worms, but this in no way would have the unintended consequence like the federal legislation banning lead in toys that would prevent ATVs or mini bikes or that has happened and closed down some industries. This would not have that unintended consequence.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, this is really to try to avoid that. So if a ban on lead were to come through, say Washington passed a ban on lead, that legislation plus all the underlying work would go to this advisory committee, and they would sort through all the issues and see if it makes sense for Minnesota, and then make a recommendation. Either Minnesota should adopt that kind of recommendation, should adopt it with modifications, or shouldn't adopt it. There'd be a lot of checks before we would ever get to the point. There's no automatic piece.
Mm-hmm. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Thiessen. After listening to Dr. Hench's earlier, I don't see it in here, but I know you and I have talked about some of the international study as well. I mean, we're obviously looking to grab California or Washington State, the Canadians, Swiss, whoever else. Is that something that could be included in kind of clearinghouse fashion for going forward, so that if somebody else comes up with better research, we can accept that as well?
Representative,
and Mr. Chair, the short answer to that is yes. I mean, this would take recommendations. It's limited to other states and the federal government. But the science that this group would look at, it's peer-reviewed scientific evidence this group would look at, would take into account all that science. That's right. Now, the one thing that's different from Russ and Knuth's, and I don't know how deep you guys got into this issue, this doesn't take a position on the precautionary principle one way or another. Some states are that we'd look to have adopted that. Some states haven't. But I think that's important to just at least have on the table for everybody.
Mr. Representative Colbert.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you look like you're going down the of looking at other states, what they have done, and we would be reviewing that data. How about if we want to develop our own, such as the Clark bill that was before us? I don't know if that's unique to Minnesota or not, but let's say it was. What kind of process will this group have to be able to do the review of that?
Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, it wouldn't particularly take that into account. So a new idea, and it's worth something worth talking about, a new idea kind of generating from Minnesota wouldn't, the way this legislation is drafted, at least right now, wouldn't make it into the process. I suppose we could set up a system to do that. On the other hand, it doesn't prevent a bill like the BPA bill from moving forward independently. So this isn't set up exactly like, for instance, the Workers' Compensation Council, where the legislature binds itself to this work. It doesn't take a position one way or another.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's an important, though, distinction that we need to make, because I don't know the science of the Clark bill or the Canoe bill or of the other things. And as Representative Mahoney said, you got one scientist says this and another scientist says that, and which friend do I want to snake mad at me, you know, kind of. And so, but there should be some process for us to have some concerns within the state of Minnesota itself to be able to come up for some kind of a peer review within that group.
And Mr. Chairman, I think the way the bill was originally drafted for the Zlito was more in that direction. One thing I'm trying to avoid here is to create a lot. I mean, we don't have a lot of money right now, so to create a lot within the agency of work. But you know, I'd be open to thinking about giving tasking this group with doing some of that work as well, if you're interested.
Then that's why the other next question I had was: is there a fiscal note to this bill?
So, Mr. Chair, I imagine there will be a small fiscal note because we're asking the PCA to do a little bit of work, and there's some per diem paid to these folks, but I don't imagine it's going to be a huge number.
So, Mr. Chair, within the Department of Commerce, staffing it, I think, right?
Department of PCA,
yeah. Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, and we can take it, I'll just request it, so, but I didn't realize you had some economic development stuff in here, and
no, we talked a little bit about that. Thank you.
I read it. So.
Long and winding road. Any other questions for the author? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 458? Okay. Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Lindsay Dahl, and we've been looking at lunch with Representative Thiessen, so I want to thank him for the time that we've had to talk about this. I am here just to kind of highlight a few concerns that Healthy Legacy has with this model that Representative Thiessen is putting forth. First of all, kind of addressing what you were bringing up, Representative Solberg, we're in favor of Representative Knuth's Health File 250 for that exact reason, that it creates a process here within the state and works within the state agencies. And that's part of our large concern with this bill is that it creates kind of an extra layer of government bureaucracy, so to speak, this advisory council that we have to look and recommend, and the PCA would be involved. But at the end of the day, the legislature is still going to have to decide on chemical bans. So we're hoping that with doing an alternate approach, year after year, the legislature isn't going to be having to take up individual chemical bans. Second of all, we're concerned about the composition of the advisory council, and kind of history has shown that sometimes it's hard for either the general public or independent scientists to be able to dedicate the time to be on these advisory councils, so we're concerned about that. We're also a little concerned about that the process would be heavily based on risk assessment. Risk assessment basically doesn't take into account a lot of the new science that shows us that some of these chemicals in children's products are actually a problem. And then finally, basically, with Representative Canuso, we're just really hoping that we can empower our state agencies to do the right thing. So, again, the bills don't have to be coming back to the legislature. So we empower the state agencies that already have staff that are well-trained to look at peer-reviewed science. And then my final comment is that also with we want to support the idea of states sharing information, as Representative Zellers brought up, and so that's really why the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse would take into account international things that were coming out there. And then finally, we want to work with Representative Thiessen on Section 4, because we think that's something that's really important for Minnesota, and there's great opportunity. Thank you.
Any other questions for the author? Any closing comments, Representative Thiessen?
No.
All right. Then the chair of the news is motion that House File 458 be recommended to pass as amended, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you.
Representative Hosh is coming on full. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 12 after. I'd informed opponents of the bill that I was going to ask that they hold or contain their testimony in 10 minutes. We are supposed to adjourn at 2:30. I do have the Nobles County Farm Bureau waiting at my office at 2:30, and I would hate to disappoint them. So, Representative Posh, if you could also hold yourself and advocates on your side to 10 minutes, that would be much appreciated. Or less to get extra credit points. Representative Posh. Mr. Reverend Tolbert, would you like to move the bill?
I would move that House File 968
be recommended
pass and
be referred
to the Committee on Commerce.
Thank you, Representative Tolbert. Representative Hosh, I understand there's an office amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think we're moving forward with the bill as it is.
With the bill as is, all right. Thank you very much. Representative Hosh, to your bill then.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, because of being pressed for time, I'm not going to go section to section. I trust that you have read the bill or at least the research summary. Essentially, what House File 968 does is establish a residential building construction board that would deal with the licensure and enforcement of individuals with a residential construction or remodeling license, and also deal with the building code. The board has 13 members. The membership is defined in Section 3, Subdivision 1. In order to have any amendments to the building code, there has to be a supermajority two-thirds vote of the entire board. So it's not just of the members present, but of the entire board. So it's designed to try to bring some consensus to the issue, to the issues before the board. This emulates other similar boards within the trade, such as the Plumbing Board, the Board of Electricity, and the Board of High Pressure Piping Systems. With that said, I would much rather turn this over to the testifiers so they can get their say.
Perfect. Thank you, Representative Hosh. Ms. Terry Weaver, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Perry Weaver. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We represent the home building and residential construction industry in the state. We're seeking a board. You're probably wondering, why is the industry even looking at a residential construction board? Why should it be established? We're seeking a board where a balanced group of industry professionals can discuss and debate issues pertaining to the industry, particularly related to our licensing requirements, any recommendation of fees, and of course, the residential construction building code. Home builders and remodelers are very, very concerned about the residential construction code, its development, its implementation, how it's enforced, how it's educated, and most importantly, how it's implemented in the field. As Representative Hosh pointed out, when we talked about developing who should be on this board, you will see that builders certainly do not have a majority on this board. As a matter of fact, there are four builders and 13 other industry professionals, and 13 industry professionals. We are only four of those 13. I was never a math major, so I think that's less than 50%. The reason is because we really recognize that there are other professionals who have played an important role in this industry, and we think they should be involved. I want to point out to you, and many of you know here because you've got experience in the residential construction industry, that we're much different than the commercial industry. A commercial builder is not licensed. A commercial builder does not have to read the building code, primarily because they hire engineers and architects to do all that for them. So a residential builder has a different type of relationship with the building code than a commercial builder does. We have to understand how it works. We have to explain it to our subcontractors. We have to explain it to homeowners. And most importantly, we have liability when it doesn't work. And so I think that is an important component to why we're asking for this bill. Every builder has to own a code book. We have to. We have to be able to read it and understand it. And I think you recognized that last year when you passed a bill that requires every jurisdiction to require home builders and remodelers to build to the building code. You did not allow any municipality to opt out. I think that was a huge step in the right direction. Our next step is requiring enforcement of the building code statewide. I think that might give some of my friends at the city some heartburn, but I really think that's the next step in making this work. In general, the industry didn't pay too much attention to the building code until about 1990. We just did what the department or anyone told us to do on the building code. But in the early 90s, when the legislature said we are going to have the most energy efficient building code in the country, I have to tell you, we weren't quite sure what we were doing. I don't think that the department quite knew what they were doing. Unfortunately, homeowners and builders are paying for some of the mistakes we have made in the building code. I'm not saying the building code doesn't work. I'm saying in some circumstances it doesn't work, and we've made it more complicated. It's more complicated than it's ever been. So, I think that as a result of that, you are hearing from homeowners who are unhappy with some of their homes. And the industry has been plagued with litigation. And the residential building code and its contents have become a document for key litigation for this industry. So I'm sure any of the plaintiff attorneys you've heard from in the last year here will tell you exactly what parts of the building code are weak, what parts are a red herring to a lawsuit, and what parts need to be changed. So you can understand why this building code is so important to us. So in 2000, we started to take a proactive approach and get involved in the code building process. And I brought Mike Swanson from Rutland Homes to tell you a little bit about his experience with the process.
Mr. Swanson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Mike Swanson. I'm Vice President of Rutland Homes and also the current President of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. I've been in the industry for over 30 years. I have served as the primary builder representative through both of the past code cycles, both on the energy code and the IRC code. The first set of code cycle that we went through, after sitting on it for a year and a half, hundreds and hundreds of hours, sitting there again, builders in the minority, building officials in the majority, after deciding what should go in the code, what should be amended out, what should be changed, we vote, write sonars, everything else, follow all the rules, and then it goes behind the curtain, and what we voted on is changed. And it's very, very disappointing after spending all that time and actually having the building officials, which it's a group from outstate Minnesota and then also a group from Building Codes and Standards here in St. Paul that are on that with a few industry suppliers and a handful of builders on it. The next set of code, when we went into the next code cycle with IRC and Energy Code Committee, I personally asked the head of Building Codes and Standards at the end of this year and a half, if there are things that we have voted on that are not going to be changed the way we have voted, would you please come back to us and explain to us why you are changing what we have voted on? And we were all assured this was both in the Energy Code Committee and in the IRC Code Committee. And this was asked of them on more than one occasion, and it came right from the top, absolutely, you deserve that. Things were changed, things were not gone through, there was no meeting after the fact to explain to us why things were changed that we voted on. And I guess the most important thing that came out of the last code cycle when it comes to, it was on the energy code, but it seems kind of odd, it was pan flashing of windows. And I was the primary leader in that, pushing for that to be put into the code, because that's one of the primary problems with the rotting houses, et cetera, if you're aware of that and have very much insight into that. The code officials did not want to put that into code. They wanted us to go with the installation instructions given by the manufacturers, in this case of windows. I brought in one of the installation instructions from one of the largest window manufacturers in the state and in the nation, which were reverse lapped, letting water come in, pass it around to everybody. Is this what you want us to do? Well, you can't do that. Absolutely, we can't do that. And it was tooth and nail to the very end, and I'm happy that we won, and pan flashing is in code in the state of Minnesota now, and it's going to make a large difference. But these are the things that having people that are actually in the field working with it, having some say, really makes a difference than people in, and I know that some of these folks do get out in the field. Reading books is different than being out there and working with it, and we do have some valuable insight that should be given, you know, the proper due, I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. My father was a machinist, and he used to always bring home pictures of drawings that, like you say, that engineers drew up and said that the things you can't build. I'm a carpenter by trade and got almost 30 years in the trade, and I don't know if this board had been in place back in the 80s and the 90s, Do you think many of the problems we're seeing today with mold in houses could have been caught and solved by people that are active and working in the trade being on a board setting these standards instead of stuff that some of the stuff that went through new window products, new window design, installation methods that came about that I think created some of the problems we're having with that? Do you think it would have been solved by this?
You're looking at each other.
Yeah. Do you want to answer?
Mr. Swanson?
Thank you, Mike Swanson. Some of the things certainly would have been caught. Some of the things, unfortunately, were unintended consequences that we didn't know the dynamics of the science of buildings when we started sealing them that tight, some of the things that were going to happen. It really wasn't anyone's fault, but I think the point maybe should have been made that some further testing should have been done before you made some big leaps like that. They were things that no one could have said for sure were going to happen, but unfortunately they did, and there's been millions and millions of dollars of damage done because of it, and there's ongoing things coming out from that.
Lots of legislation as well.
Thank you.
Is Representative Hosh, do you have anyone else wanting to testify on your side?
Not at the time.
All right. Thank you. I have Brian Hoffman, Kathy, is it Osmondson?
Yes.
And then on deck we'll have Ron Sonic and Roger Axel, and I also have a Niall Zickman. Welcome to the committee. Good to see you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair and committee members.
We would like to hold the totality of the opponents to about 10 minutes, if we could.
Absolutely. I will try to be brief here.
Please say your name for the record, then proceed, Mr. Hoffman.
My name is Brian Hoffman, and I'm here today representing the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, and we represent code officials throughout the state who work for local government units. And while I agree that many of the items here, comments said, yes, there are, can always be improvements to the code adoption process, and you know what? I worked for a city for the last 10 years. The public process is the most important thing you can do, is to have it inclusive and have people engaged so that all the stakeholders are involved. Great idea. Unfortunately, the bill being proposed does not address that. Building code is a complex system. It's not a single thing. And this scope of the bill here is very wide. There is no residential code in the state of Minnesota. There's a state construction code that's made up of various components. There's a building code. There's a one- and two-family component. But the way that this is worded, this addresses all residential. This isn't just houses. A 20-story condominium building would be technically regulated by this board. Now, someone tell me, please, how a carpenter or a mobile home installer or a lumber yard owner, with the best intentions, is able to accurately and intelligently have conversations about concrete, structural elements, life safety, exiting, mechanical systems. Just don't see it happening. The scope here is so wide that this board, while it's made up primarily of carpenters and home builders, even on a house, there's nothing in here dealing with mechanical systems. And the structural elements that go into a house, too, are not being addressed. The board is made up of a very small group of people. I remember a couple of years ago sitting in front of a committee meeting listening to Representative Mahoney. And at that time, we were discussing electrical and plumbing and high-pressure boards. And he made a comment that I totally respect and I agree with and I think stands today, is that every member on that electrical board was a licensed electrician, except for the public members. That means they went to school. They went through an apprenticeship. They became licensed. They knew that system. They know the electrical system. And while conceptually the board, it is true that at least everybody on that board can intelligently have a discussion about what would go into the electrical code. This board is covering a whole realm and variety of building systems that go in from all the way from structural through mechanical and exiting that really, with in my years of experience in this, I don't know, honestly, if there are that many people who really are versed in all of these areas who can develop codes for the public safety on this. You know, another item in this bill that I felt was very interesting on line 2.25, I've been about 25 years in the industry here as a code official, licensed building official. I have degrees in civil engineering and building inspection, And that wouldn't even be qualified to sit on this board as a code official because I haven't worked as a carpenter for 4 years. I think what we need to do is take a look at how people can be engaged and involved with the code process. But I would urge you that this bill has wide-ranging repercussions and goes way beyond talking about how to build and what codes we should have for a home. This is basically about consumer protection in the very end, and we need to be very careful how we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Osmondson. Welcome. Please say your name to the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Kathy Osmondson. I am a certified building official and a fire marshal. That's my full-time job. So I wear two hats and see two sides of this proposal. I'm also very involved in the code development process. The ICC is the current code that we have adopted here in the state of Minnesota. It's also adopted by our neighboring states so that there is some consistency for the trades when they go from state to state with their building. The ICC code committees do have a wide representation of committee members, from engineers to the trades to similar to what they have outlined in this bill is already in place on a national, in fact, international level. Anybody can submit code changes to the ICC process, and I think to have a specific Minnesota code would be taking a step backwards from getting everybody on the same page as far as building safety, life safety, and consistency in code enforcement as well. Those are my life safety concerns with this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney, I didn't see your hand.
Quick question. I've gone round and round with the ICC, and I'll ask one simple question because you brought up the fact that everyone gets to vote on the ICC. Could you define who everyone is? Because my understanding is that it's only the building officials unless they change it over the last couple of years.
As far as voting, it is code... I'm sorry.
I'm supposed to call on you before
you talk. I'm sorry.
No need.
He can't get his children to listen either.
or Representative Mahoney.
There you go. As far as voting, it is the code authorities that do the voting, but as far as sitting on the committees themselves, there's a wide variety of individuals sitting on the committees that hear those votes and make recommendations on those votes.
So an engineer, an architect, someone with 4 years of school wouldn't necessarily be able to vote on it.
Ms. Osmondson.
It's a governmental unit that has the vote in the ICC, yes, the inspector or the code enforcement person. Correct.
All right.
I think I made my point.
Okay. Mr. Sonic?
Excuse me, could I, do have a representative from the ICC Board of Directors here.
Oh,
Greg
all right.
Johnson, could I invite him
very,
to speak?
Very briefly, yes.
Please
come up to the microphone, you're being taped. Introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Greg Johnson, I serve on the Board of Directors of the International Code Council, and I'd like to clarify what Kathy was speaking to. The process is slightly more complicated than was addressed and is addressed by Representative Mahoney's question. The code development process of the International Code Council is a legislative process by which anybody can participate in the process. The way it works is we have a model code that's suitable for adoption by state and local government. People that propose changes to that model code go to a code development hearing. And at that code development hearing, the members of the committee listen to testimony on the changes being proposed. The members of that committee can be industry, can be code officials. For example, the International Residential Code Committee is comprised of 12 individuals, four of whom are home builders. And that's a contractual relationship we have with the National Association of Home Builders. At that first committee hearing, everybody in the audience is permitted to vote in cases where the committee is being challenged. So everybody can vote at that stage. It's only the final action hearing vote that is restricted to governmental employees. The philosophy of the governmental code development process is is that only people who do not have an interest, a financial interest, in the outcome of the code development process should ultimately determine the content of the code.
Okay, we're going to have to do this very quickly if we can. Thank you very much.
I'm done, sir.
Thank you. Next on the list, then, is there Roger Axel, is that correct?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Roger Axel. I am a building official. And
you can write quickly, please.
For the record, I am also a licensed residential building contractor.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to speak here. I'm very concerned about the language of this proposed bill in that it allows a group of individuals who have an interest other than public safety in the construction of residential properties, residential buildings. As a building official, the choice of product is your choice as a builder. You can use it if you want, provided it does not compromise structural integrity, life safety, fire issues, things like that. When you use an oak door, pine door, steel door, I don't care. My concern is that with a board that's heavily loaded by the industry, they can make decisions that are going to dictate public safety based on a bottom line dollar amount rather than the public safety element. So I'm not going to repeat a lot of the issues that were already brought up. A lot of comments already made, very important comments. But there are a lot of loopholes in this language. Particularly, I want to bring up one item that was mentioned, that in the voting process, it just says a quorum. And it says a majority of the members of the board qualified to vote. But would that not mean that all the members on this board should be qualified to vote? And by the language of this bill, it just says a two-thirds majority. It does not state that all members have to vote on the issue. And so, again, it raises questions about who's going to drive the boat in this thing. It seems like the regulators are regulating their own industry, which creates a conflict of interest, in my opinion.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, sir.
Niall, I'm sorry, get the right name.
Mr. Chairman, members, Niall Zickman, and I got the be brief message. Speaking for the Minnesota Fire Chiefs, Minnesota Fire Department Association, and the local fire marshals in opposition to the bill, and just to get on the record how often we testify in opposition. The last time was 5 years ago. Representative Lucantin has fireworks bill. We don't typically oppose bills, and we've now with the Representative Holshin expressed our concerns, he knows those, but I would just like to emphasize this is a major public policy issue. The fundamental purpose of the government is public safety, and in the Fire and Building Code, we use the code as the foundation on how we design our entire systems. So without belaboring that point, you're transferring that fundamental purpose of government over to the private sector that has a different motive, and they should, rightly so, and you're absolving the public agency of doing that, but yet you leave us with the burden of going specifically to the firefighters into these homes that we will no longer have the control of the code over. And I just think that's a policy you should ponder deeply and think through quite a bit before we move on. And I have a lot more to say, but I appreciate the committee's time. So thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. Representative Mahoney, quickly.
I'll be very brief. These are the same arguments I heard when I tried to establish the high-pressure piping, the plumbing, and the electrical board. The bill has some work to do, as evidenced, any kind of code bill. I'm on the third cleanup bill of my bill, so I would expect the author to continue working with people, but I'm going to support the author in moving this thing forward.
Okay, Representative Haas?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the testimony today. The members of the committee have my word that I will work with individuals to try to tighten this up. I am willing to change the composition of the board. I am willing to address issues such as sprinkling. A few things I want to clarify real quick. It says that right here on line 6.4 and 6.5 that the amendments for the building code must receive an affirmative two-thirds majority vote of all of the voting members of the board. And I think that's relatively clear. And just to make sure that I think everybody is aware that the building profession takes serious its competency, its integrity, and its profession. And I think that will be reflected within this board. So I would appreciate the committee's support.
Okay, we're kind of running a little bit over time, but is there anybody in the audience that feels absolutely compelled to testify for or against? If, yeah. You need to come up to the table, please.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, on the way up.
Sure.
Representative Hosh and to the members working on it, Representative Mahoney as well. The firefighters are a voice for a lot of us bipartisanly, and I do hope the message has been relayed by them, but for our side as well, that's a very, very big concern for us, and we appreciate your consideration.
Okay, welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself to the tape and give testimony very quickly.
Hi, I'm Larry Huff, work for the city of Maple Grove.
Okay.
I have been a building inspector, building official, state of Minnesota for many years, and I do know what Mr. Swanson is speaking of as far as the energy code goes. It was not the building code that required certain things when we had house problems. I think on a national basis, we do an excellent job. And Minnesota amends it to fit Minnesota. We have a lot of folks that don't follow the code. Contractors should. They should own a code book, one would think. So we try to give them the information they need and can build a better home. Products out there, I don't know how this board could test them or create something that will make it better than what we already have. We as individuals have to step forward and make sure we do the job that needs to be done. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Is that HUFF?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
If not, then the chair will renew his motion that House File 968 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce. I think that's your next step. And you have a couple other ones after that, I think, there's more to go through as well. So, any other discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. And there's a couple of announcements. We will do Gunther's bill this afternoon.
No.
Oh, right now? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1364 to the committee. I don't know if there's any.
It's pretty straightforward.
To the committee.
In the second house, I can bring it up for you if you'd like.
Do you want to do that?
Yep.
Representative Zeller moves that House File 1364 be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Mahoney, do you want to just
I can briefly tell you what this bill does. Right now, a good number of the school employees are getting their boiler license. This just seeks to add some hours of required training and require them to keep track of that. This is a bill that was brought forth by it was written with great help from the chief boiler inspectors, and it's supported by as much as the unofficial boiler inspector and SEIU. It just gives them more training for people to operate boilers in schools. And it requires a school to keep track of it.
Okay. Anybody in the audience that wish to testify for or against this bill? MSBA? Welcome to the committee and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And it is our assumption, Mr. Chair, that this is not a fiscal cost for local districts. That really, on the worst-case scenario, there would be two engineers in the building to cover this 8 hours over a year. After 5 years, then this individual could have the chief boiler's license and train other employees going forward. So we see this as a no-cost school district.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Any other discussion? Then Representative Zellers, if you could renew your motion, House File 1364 be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. Do we have to move again? And the meeting is adjourned.